So Genesis chapter 21, we're continuing to look at the life of Abraham. In last week's sermon, though, we kind of took a little bit of a detour and we were looking at Galatians chapter 4, reason being, in Galatians chapter 4, Paul offers a commentary on the events that took place in Abraham's household with regards to his two wives and his two sons. And Paul indicates that the two wives, Hagar and Sarah, and the two sons that were conceived by these women, Ishmael and Isaac, they're actually representative of two different covenants. So Ishmael was born according to the flesh, simply Sarah and Abraham coming up with the idea that Hagar could be a surrogate mother and bring a child into the world for them. So he was a child of the flesh, a child of human ingenuity or human works, representing a covenant of works. And then there was Isaac, born to Sarah, and he was a child of promise. And Abraham was obviously involved in the conception, but it was impossible, humanly speaking, for Sarah to conceive. And so the Lord was involved in her pregnancy. He enabled her to conceive, and so he's supernaturally conceived. And so Sarah and Isaac represent a covenant of grace. So, of course, there was a disruption in the household with regards to the two children, and the child born of the flesh and his mother could no longer stay in the household, depicting for us the idea that unbelief cannot remain with belief with God's people. And Paul touches on these issues, and he says to us that these women and their sons are representative of these two different covenants. And the reason why Paul does this is because in the Galatian context, he's dealing with the issue of grace and works. There were Judaizers who were troubling the early church, and they were saying that people need the Lord Jesus Christ, but they also need Moses' law. So you trust in Christ and then you need to be circumcised. You need the dietary requirements. You need the ceremonial washings. You need to keep the Sabbath. So it's Christ plus all of these things. And the point being, of course, as we know, that anything added to grace, and grace ceases to be grace. We are saved by grace alone through faith alone. And, you know, Paul is absolutely emphatic that these truths must stand. Otherwise, the gospel is undermined. And so there is a right place for obedience and good works, most certainly the right kind of obedience and good works. But they are not a prerequisite to grace, nor are they an addition to grace. They are a response to grace. And we need to understand these things. And so Paul's point in all of this is for us to understand that we exist either under a covenant of works or a covenant of grace. And if we exist under a covenant of works, we will not be saved, and ultimately we will be cast out like Hagar and Ishmael. If we exist under a covenant, that's a covenant of works, is that what I said? Sorry, a covenant of works. If we exist under a covenant of grace, then we are born again, born by the Spirit of God, and we will be saved. That is the new birth. So we're continuing on then in Genesis chapter 21, and we pick it up at verse 22, and we'll read through to the end of the chapter, which is verse 34. So Genesis chapter 21, beginning at verse 22. And it came to pass at that time that Abimelech and Phicol, the commander of his army, spoke to Abraham, saying, God is with you in all that you do. Now, therefore, swear to me by God that you will not deal falsely with me, with my offspring or with my posterity, but that according to the kindness that I have done to you, you will do to me and to the land in which you have dwelt. And Abraham said, I will swear. Then Abraham rebuked Abimelech because of a well of water which Abimelech's servants had seized. And Abimelech said, I do not know who has done this thing. You did not tell me, nor had I heard of it until today. So Abraham took sheep and oxen and gave them to Abimelech, and the two of them made a covenant. And Abraham set 7 ewe lambs of the flock by themselves. Then Abimelech asked Abraham, "What is the meaning of these 7 ewe lambs which you have set by themselves?" And he said, "You will take these 7 ewe lambs from my hand, that they may be my witness that I have dug this well." Therefore he called the place Beersheba, because the two of them swore an oath there. Thus they made a covenant at Beersheba. So Abimelech rose with Phicol, the commander of his army, and they returned to the land of the Philistines. Then Abraham planted a tamarisk tree in Beersheba, and there called on the name of the Lord, the everlasting God. And Abraham stayed in the land of the Philistines many days. And we're kind of back to some normality, I suppose. There's been a fair bit of action in the account of Abraham, and not just Abraham, but Lot and the destruction of Sodom and Lot's family. And then the commotion in Abraham's household. So a fair bit's been going on in the life of this man and those around him. But this is a fairly ordinary situation that's before us. And we can see Abraham living life and just dealing with the issues of life. So I want to make 3 observations then based on these verses, 3 things I want to consider. First of all, the character of Abraham. Abraham's character, verses 22 and 23. "And it came to pass at that time that Abimelech and Phicol, the commander of his army, spoke to Abraham, saying, 'God is with you in all that you do. Now, therefore, swear to me by God that you will not deal falsely with me, with my offspring, or with my posterity, but that according to the kindness that I have done to you, you will do to me and to the land in which you have dwelt.'" Now, it helps us to go back a little and just to recall the previous history between Abimelech and Abraham. And you may remember that in chapter 20. So Abraham had made the decision to take his family south, and they stayed in Gerar. And things played out for Abraham pretty much as they had done when he went previously further south into the land of Egypt. So we don't know why Abraham went down to Gerar. We know why he went to Egypt, because of drought. Later on, he goes south again to Gerar. He's still within the general area of the promised land, but well south in the promised land. Why he went down there, we don't know. But it's the same kind of scenario that we see in Egypt. Sarah and Abraham come up with this idea that if they are questioned about their relationship, they will say that they are brother and sister. And of course, Abraham is fearful that if men in the region discover that she is his wife, they may kill him. Because apparently, Sarah, even in older age, was a very attractive woman, and a man may want her. And if she's married, Abraham could be murdered. So then she is a widow and she's available to marry. And so they have this idea, if they say they're brother and sister, then they'll leave him alone. And it is a half truth. They descend from the same father, but they have different mothers. And a half truth, as we know, is a complete lie. And so this is the story that they come up with, because Abraham is fearful for his life. And sure enough, according to the script, up steps the king of the land, Abimelech, and he decides that he would like to add Sarah to his harem. So he throws her over his shoulder, as it were, and he marches her off with all of the rest of his women. And God intervenes. He prevents adultery taking place. We don't know what he does, but somehow, providentially, he stops Abimelech from sleeping with Sarah. And further to this, he also warns Abimelech in a dream that he is not to touch this woman, or devastation will come upon him and upon all the people in the land. Now, Abimelech responds to this by rebuking Abraham. "Why did you concoct this story? Why were you not straight with me? You know, you've put me and my family and all of the people in a precarious situation. And what we find with Abimelech is that he's actually a man of great integrity, and he responds to the situation well. He actually gives gifts to Abraham and Sarah, gives them livestock. He gives them land to use, and he blesses them. And he proves to be a good man. He gives to them a lot of money, in fact. And Abraham then stays in the region around Beersheba. So that's the background, and we pick things up again, knowing this interaction that took place. We pick it up here in chapter 21, verse 22, and we're told, "And it came to pass at that time." It came to pass at that time. So the time that's referred to here is the general time that Hagar and Ishmael were cast out of the household. Around that time, Abimelech and his army commander Phicol come and speak to Abraham. And Abimelech wants to be on good terms with Abraham. Let's remember that Abraham is staying in that general region. He's on the land that ultimately belongs to Abimelech. And Abimelech and his commander come, and they want terms of peace. They want to get on well with their neighbors. They want this peaceful existence between both of their people groups. And what we have here is the lesser approaching the greater. And we sort of see that circumstances have turned from what they were previously. It's the lesser approaching the greater, seeking terms of peace and goodwill. And that's always the way that it occurs. We do not find the United States of America going to Papua New Guinea seeking shelter and refuge and goodwill and guarantees of security. But we do find that kind of thing the other way, of course. The lesser country going to the greater seeking guarantees of peace and goodwill. Ronald Reagan, that obviously well-known American president, he said, you need to be in a position of power to negotiate peace. If you don't have power, you're at the mercy of those who do. And Abimelech is appealing to a man who is now of much greater power than he is. And he goes to Abraham saying, God is with you in all that you do. And so Abimelech is acknowledging the blessing of God that's come upon Abraham. He knew that Abraham had not just prospered by luck. He didn't have all of these herds and flocks and servants and family members and wealth by luck. He understood that Sarah had not conceived in her very old age by way of luck. He knew that the divine blessing rested upon Abraham. God was with him and his family and his servants. And I think it can be argued that the evidence of God being with anyone ultimately is not simply external success, but the kind of person that they are, the manner of life that they live. Why does Abimelech go to Abraham in the first place? Because he's confident of a positive response. He knows now Abraham is the greater man. He has the greater resources. The blessing of God is upon him, but he is assured of a positive response, that Abraham is not going to dismiss him or ride roughshod over him. And Abimelech would be fully aware that God had dealt graciously with him over Sarah and given him time to address the issue of Sarah within his harem and to do what was right and appropriate. And he's conscious of the fact that Abraham is God's man. Now, Abraham had lied to begin with. He lied under pressure, but clearly God was with him. He was God's man. Abraham was a godly man. And here is the appeal. Now, therefore, swear to me by God that you will not deal falsely with me as he had in the past, with my offspring or with my posterity, but that according to the kindness that I have done to you, you will do to me and to the land in which you have dwelt. So Abimelech knows that Abraham takes God seriously, swear to me by God. I think it raises something for us to think about. Immediately there is application for all of us. How do people see us? Is it evident that God is with us in terms of how we behave, how we live, our priorities and our concerns, our manner of speech? Is it obvious that we take God seriously and we can be trusted to deal honestly and fairly with people? We can be taken at our word. And as I was thinking about this during the week, I couldn't help but reflect upon yet again the significant moral failures of a very well-known Christian pastor that are now obviously in the public domain. And these things are not minor issues. And you know, the world is sick of being lectured by clerical hypocrites, by men getting up and parading around and telling everybody how it is. And then it comes to light that their lives are nothing, you know, in relation to what they expect of others. And interestingly enough, prior to the news breaking with regards to this man, and I'm sure you all know who I'm referring to, just prior to this, several weeks ago, I listened to an interview of a fellow who was involved in that church setup many, many years ago, man who was actually responsible for putting them on the map with his music and all of the songs that he had written. And I remember when I was in the Pentecostal scene hearing this man speak. He was a very, very prominent man. And I remember back in those days, out of the blue, he walked away from it all. And really, the success of this church, which is now a global empire, it really began with him and the songs that he was writing. And he put them on the map, and then unexpectedly, he walked away from it all and basically walked into obscurity. In Pentecostal circles, this man was a household identity, a household name. And he's really been unheard of ever since. And there was this interview with him conducted not that long ago. In fact, I think it was last year. And he spoke about once they started to get this name for themselves, and once they started to become popular and publish their CDs and all of this stuff, how it got to the heads of those in leadership and how badly people were treated in the church, and the head guy, how he was so hungry for success and driven by success, and the kind of despotic leadership, and how superficial it all became, just about success and money and people and all of this kind of stuff. And in the end, he could take no more. He'd had enough. It was a debacle, and he walked away from it all. In fact, sadly, he's actually walked away entirely from the Christian faith. Aggressive leadership, hungry for money, hungry for success, driven. I don't believe in muckraking. I don't believe in just airing people's dirty laundry for the sake of my sermon. But I do believe there are lessons that we need to learn. And absolutely central to the Christian faith is integrity and honesty and fairness and being a person of your word. And we've seen Paul refer to this in his own ministry with the Corinthians and the accusations that were being made against him. And he's saying these things are not true. I am an honest man. I labor for the glory of God. I am not guilty of the things of which I have been accused. What testimony do we bear to those around us, amongst our family members, in the workplace, in the community? You know, a wise man said to me many years ago, we have a certain perception of ourselves. You know what really matters is the perception that others have of us. How do other people see us? Abimelech could say of Abraham, God is with you in all that you do. Can it be said of us? God is in our actions. God is in our behavior. God is in our speech. God is in our priorities. Now, we all stumble at points just as Abraham did. Abraham had his faults. But the one thing with godliness is that it is consistent and it is evident. Someone might stumble, but it's clearly obvious whether or not they are godly and sincere and they are people of integrity and they fear the Lord and they love the Lord and they take his word seriously. Those things should be manifestly evident. How is it that Christian ministers get accused of womanizing and drinking and drugs and cooking the books and taking money and making a profit out of religion? And this kind of stuff goes on and on and on. It matters what people think. It matters how the world sees us. And in all of its accusations against the Christian faith and its hatred of righteousness and morality and truth, never let it be said of any of us that we are not people who are honest and people of integrity and decency, and we stick to our word and we are faithful and hardworking and et cetera, et cetera. These things matter. Here is a pagan king who can look at Abraham and he can say, I know that the Lord is with you. And it's not just that he's increased in flocks and herds and servants, but he can see that he is a man of integrity and he's a man who is approachable. Abimelech feels comfortable to go to the stronger man and to make an appeal, knowing that he will be well received. For all of his mistakes and his sins and his inconsistencies, Abraham is a man of good character. Now, the second thing I want us to note is Abraham's covenant. Abraham's covenant, verses 24 to 31. And Abraham said, I will swear. Then Abraham rebuked Abimelech because of a well of water which Abimelech's servants had seized. And Abimelech said, I do not know who has done this thing. You did not tell me, nor had I heard of it until today. So Abraham took sheep and oxen and gave them to Abimelech, and the two of them made a covenant. And Abraham set seven ewe lambs of the flock by themselves. Then Abimelech asked Abraham, what is the meaning of these seven ewe lambs which you have set by themselves? And he said, you will take these seven ewe lambs from my hand, that they may be my witness that I have dug this well. Therefore he called that place Beersheba, because the two of them swore an oath there. So in verse 24, Abraham agrees to the request or to the appeal that was made by Abimelech. Then in verse 25, Abraham reproves King Abimelech over an issue related to a well. Now, what seems to have happened is this. Either Abraham or more likely his workers, because Abraham, let us remember now, is over 100 years old. He's 102, 103 years old, something like that. So more than likely Abraham's workers have dug this well for their flocks, and the well has been seized by force by some of Abimelech's workers. They've come and taken it. And more than likely, they've said to Abraham's men, this land belongs to our king. This well belongs to our king, and we need it for our flocks. And so they've taken possession of the well that Abraham or his men, most likely his men, that they've dug. And Abraham recognizes that if they are to be friends and have a good rapport and they're to get on with this covenant and living together peacefully, then this matter needs to be resolved, needs to be raised, and it needs to be discussed. Verse 26, Abimelech indicates that he had no knowledge what had taken place. This is the first that he's heard of it. He knew nothing of this. So he didn't organize it, and he doesn't agree with what's happened. He doesn't sanction what's taken place. He's not in any way responsible for the actions of his workers. He didn't know that it had even happened. And so he puts this to Abraham, and Abraham, in response, establishes a covenant verse 27. He gives to Abimelech sheep and oxen. And most certainly these animals were intended for sacrifice. The covenant was sealed with blood. I want us to notice again here that Abraham is leading the way. Just as Abimelech had led the way when he returned Sarah to Abraham. Abimelech provided gifts, and Abraham also in turn provides gifts. He wants good relations, and he's prepared to give the animals for a covenant. In verses 28 to 30, Abraham set aside seven female lambs. And it would seem that these animals were not to be slaughtered. These animals were merely an offering, a goodwill gesture. And Abraham, it would seem, is effectively saying, look, I dug the well and the land that you have given to me. It's only fair that I use the well. However, I want to give you something in return. Abraham's not just sort of putting his foot down, the stronger man. My workers dug the well. You gave me the land. It's my well. I'll use the well. The man is so exceedingly gracious. You gave me the land, but it is only fair that I use the well that we've dug. However, let me give to you something in return. This is purely a goodwill gesture. I take possession of the well, I use it for my flocks, but I, as it were, don't want you to be out of pocket. I want to give you something in return. Here are seven ewe lambs. You take them as evidence that the well is mine, but here's a gift for you. And I'll mention in a moment the significance of the number seven. Verse 31, this arrangement was agreeable to Abimelech, and the two men swear an oath. We can effectively say here that these two guys shake hands, it's all good, they're on friendly terms, and then they depart. There's two principles here I want to draw to your attention. I think two important things. The first one is this. We have a picture here of two men behaving, both of them, in an exemplary way. Abimelech was a pagan king. Yet he was generous, he was fair, he was reasonable. He returned Sarah to Abraham, and you would expect him to do so after he'd been warned in a dream by God, but it didn't stop there. He gives to Abraham money, he gives him land to use, he gives him livestock. Everything about Abimelech is praiseworthy. He's a good man. You look at Abraham, at least to begin with, Abraham lied. Now, he's not lying or being dishonest or sinful in any way here, but to begin with, Abraham was not honest with Abimelech, yet there is nothing whatsoever by which we can point the finger at Abimelech. He has been reasonable throughout. Yes, he's a pagan king and he's got this harem of women. But in terms of his dealings with Abraham and his conduct and his character, he is a good, reputable man. Now, we know spiritually that the world is opposed to the church, and we've seen this in a kind of symbolic form or a representative form in terms of Ishmael and Isaac, and Ishmael taunting Isaac and the idea that ultimately, truth and error, belief and unbelief will not coexist together. God will cast out unbelief. We know spiritually speaking that the world is opposed to the church. And at the same time, we also have to say that as much as is possible, we should seek to be at peace with the world. And obviously I mean peace in the right way. I don't mean peace by compromise. Unbelievers have a different worldview to us, but they don't all behave in an unscrupulous way. They are not all openly hostile to the church. And I've mentioned previously, there are occasions when it is perfectly legitimate and good for Christian people to form organizations and associations and have contracts and business arrangements and all of these kinds of things with unconverted people. There are Christians who would sort of stamp and jump around in terms of what I've just said, and won't have a bar of it. Christians that have nothing to do on that kind of level with the world, that is nonsense. We find at times that believers in the Old Covenant, under the Old Covenant, formed pacts and alliances and had business arrangements and dealings with the unconverted, with the pagans. And we find it here. We've seen it with Abraham previously. If you remember, when he went to rescue his nephew Lot, he had an alliance with two other pagan kings. Governments have seen the benefits of Christianity in society, and there are times when church and state can cooperate and work together. Proverbs 16, verse 7, when a man's ways please the Lord, he makes even his enemies to be at peace with him. Now, Abraham and Abimelech were not cut from the same spiritual cloth. They could not pray together. They were not cut from the same spiritual cloth. Nevertheless, God established peace between them, and more than peace. They were able to cut a covenant together in which they could dwell, through which they could dwell in the land on good terms. A week or so ago, I was reading about a publishing house in Dundee in Scotland. It still exists. It was established in the Victorian period. And I was just interested in the origins, and I won't go into the background as to why I read all sorts of stuff for different reasons. And I won't mention the name of the publishing house either. But the man who started this publishing house, he's described as a very serious religious man, a man of very high moral standards. And when he commenced this work, and it grew very quickly, and they were publishing newspapers and periodicals and magazines and all of those kinds of things, and a description of this man and his publishing house and the factory and all of that, it was said of him that he refused to employ Roman Catholics. He was a Protestant, and he refused to employ any Catholics. And this was not unusual in places like Scotland. And in Northern Ireland, like in the shipyards of Northern Ireland, owned by wealthy Protestant businessmen, some of whom had rules that no Catholics were to be employed. And I understand the principle that we are to do good firstly to the household of faith. But surely this is discriminatory and of no value to anyone whatsoever. How were these people to put bread in their mouths and to put shoes on the feet of their children? And of course, many Protestants who were employed are not genuine Christians. They're just Protestant in name. And some of you would be familiar with the name Thomas Chalmers, the Scottish minister and theologian. And he was very outspoken about this issue. This is nothing but discrimination against people who needed work and needed goodwill shown to them. What is wrong with the Christian church when it is so inward-looking and so unnecessarily harsh and sectarian? What a wonderful witness to unbelievers than to offer them work and to bring them in and to seek to make their difficult lives a little bit easier by providing employment. Sometimes it seems to me that the Christian church and even the strand to which we belong, that it is characterized by so much introspection and inward kind of an inward kind of looking approach to things and a harshness and a kind of finger pointing that exists and a pushing people away rather than an outreach and goodwill and seeking to do what we can to show the Christian faith to those who are unbelievers. Matthew chapter 5, 43 to 45. In the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, 43 to 45, Jesus said, "You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies. Bless those who curse you. Do good to those who hate you. And pray for those who spitefully use and persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. For he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. There needs to be a whole lot more of that in our lives and in the Christian church. The world may hate us. We are not to hate the world. The world may treat us poorly. We are not to treat the world poorly. How much good could have been done by those shipyards and factories and offices opening their doors to everyone so that they might obtain work and be able to earn a living and see the goodwill of Christian people to all rather than no Catholics employed? Of what benefit is that to anyone? So that's one principle I think we see here. Two men, one a believer, one an unbeliever, who are able to cooperate, and we see exemplary behaviour on both accounts. The second principle I want to draw to your attention is this. These two men provide examples of how to deal with a contentious issue. Abraham raised this matter of the well. As I mentioned, he knew it needed to be put there on the table. It needed to be discussed. There needed to be some kind of resolution if they were to move forward in a productive way. I have this well. We dug it with our own hands. Your men came and seized it. That's not right. I think we see in this that principle which is taught to us by our Lord Jesus Christ, Matthew chapter 18, beginning at verse 15. Moreover, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. If he hears you, you have gained your brother. Okay, I understand that's in relation to the church and Christians, but it's an abiding principle. It relates to our dealings with people. And I think we see it here with Abraham. There was a problem with Abimelech. It needed to be sorted out. Go to your brother, speak to your brother, and hopefully you win your brother. The situation is resolved. Jesus goes on, but if he will not hear you, take with you one or two more, that by the mouth of two or three witnesses every word may be established. And if he refuses to hear them, tell it to the church. But if he refuses even to hear the church, let him be to you like a heathen and a tax collector. Seek to address issues. Go to someone, speak to them, try and try again and try to resolve things. And if you can't get anywhere, take one or two to hear the matter. Sit and listen and to try and find a reasonable resolution. If after going and reasoning and witnesses, then it may need to be taken to the church, but things need to be resolved. The passage that was read to us earlier in Ephesians chapter 4, the Apostle Paul says, verses 26 and 27, be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your wrath, nor give place to the devil. Seek to resolve things as quickly as you can. The longer you leave them, the more room the devil has to play. Now, Abimelech indicates that he had no knowledge of the situation. He wasn't aware of what had gone on. It was the first that he knew anything of this. He doesn't put his foot down. So, well, hang on a minute. Really, it is my land. The water in the well really ultimately belongs to me. You know, you can move on somewhere else if you want. If you want a well, why don't you move on somewhere else? And he understands if he allowed Abraham to stay there, then Abraham had to make use of the land, and Abraham wasn't doing anything unreasonable. They dug a well. They needed to use it for their flocks. And Abimelech understands this, and he's perfectly reasonable about it. And Abraham in turn responds by providing livestock to sacrifice for the covenant and then livestock as a gift. If I get the well, you can have some sheep. The spirit of this meeting is completely cordial. It's all reasonable. It's out there. It's put on the table. They discuss they both want an amicable resolution. How many situations escalate and degenerate because people are unreasonable, hard-hearted? They won't listen. It's about them and their rights. You know, the way Christians sometimes treat one another, a lack of maturity, a lack of honesty, an unwillingness to hear one's neighbour, an unwillingness to be fair, to discuss things, quite simply, at times, it is astonishing at how Christians respond to one another and treat one another. Galatians chapter 5, 14 and 15. Paul says, "For all the law is fulfilled in one word, even this, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. But if you bite and devour one another, beware lest you be consumed by one another." Paul is recognizing that with some of the difficulties that existed in the churches of Galatia, that potentially people could turn on one another. And he describes them as with dog-like behavior. You know, don't be vicious to one another and tear one another apart. The law is fulfilled through love. Now, we as elders, the three of us as elders, are involved in two situations regarding other churches, nothing to do with Southern Districts, because we've been called in and have some involvement as sounding boards to try and resolve a breakdown in relationships between other people, involving ministers and others, because people just can't get along. We are supposed to be a witness to the world. I've seen in some pastoral situations where somebody is wrong in something. They are wrong. And to try and get an acknowledgement or a, you know what, you are right and I'm sorry and that would be the end of the matter, it is easier to get blood out of a stone. They would rather fight and kick and scream and it's their word against mine and it's this, and rather than saying, you know what, there is some truth to what you're saying and I'm sorry. And the matter would be essentially dealt with. Go to your brother, be reasonable, talk things through. For some Christians, it's just too hard. Look at Abraham, look. Have some sheep. Abimelech, look, I'm sorry, I didn't know it happened, but I can understand. It's your well. Take the well. Thank you for the sheep. It's all good. It's all cordial. It's all handshaking. And let's be fair. Let's talk. We can exist together as neighbours. There's been a problem between our workers, but it's not insurmountable. Some people just want to, you know, they just put their flag in the ground and by God, they will not budge. You know, sometimes the world does better than the church. And somebody like Abimelech can teach the church a thing or two about goodwill and good relations and being fair-minded and generous and willing to listen and willing to be reasonable. And these two men are exemplary examples of just getting along, being gracious, and solving a problem that had arisen. So the third thing I want to draw to your attention is Abraham's commitment. Abraham's commitment, verses 32 to 34. "Thus they made a covenant at Beersheba. So Abimelech rose with Phicol, the commander of his army, and they returned to the land of the Philistines. And Abraham planted a tamarisk tree in Beersheba, and there called on the name of the Lord, the everlasting God. And Abraham stayed in the land of the Philistines many days." So Abraham and Abimelech make a covenant and separate on good terms. Verse 31, Abraham names the place Beersheba in recognition of this event. And it's a composite word, Beer related to the well, Sheba related to the number seven. And as you're aware, with the number seven, it represents the idea of completion or fullness. And the picture that we have here in the end is that of Abraham as a settled man. You know, he has the son promised to him by God. He's now living in a portion of the land that was promised to him by God. And so Beersheba, if you think of a map of the Holy Land and you have the Dead Sea, Beersheba is to the southerly part of the Dead Sea, right down there in the south. And it's halfway between the Dead Sea and the Mediterranean. So that's the area where Abraham is living. He's finally settled here. And, you know, we've been familiar now through all of these sermons how Abraham has wandered around here and there, and he's a nomadic kind of fellow, to and fro all over the place. But now he's digging wells. He's settled. He has his son of promise. And here he is in the land. In verse 33, he plants a tamarisk tree. He is committed to this place. He's dug a well here. This is where he intends to stay. Now, the terebinth tree, it's a very functional tree. The terebinth tree, from all accounts, I'm not a botanist, so I look these things up to find out about them. I don't intuitively know any of this stuff. But the terebinth tree, from all accounts, is an evergreen. So it's a good tree for shade. It emits a kind of saltiness apparently through its foliage, which is good for food. You can use it in cooking, and some animals like to eat the leaves. The bark on the tree apparently can be used for dyeing, for tanning things, and the timber from the tree is good for building. So this tree is an all-rounder. It grows well in the area. It needs a good deal of water, but it's a good tree to have around because it's used for multiple purposes. So here we have the wanderer making a home, even if in a temporary sense. He is making a home here, Beersheba. Kyle and Delitch, in their commentary on the Old Testament, they suggest the planting of this long-lived tree with its hardwood and its long, narrow, thickly clustered evergreen leaves was to be a type of the ever-enduring grace of the faithful covenant of God. And verse 33, we find Abraham calling upon the name of the Lord. He's done this before. We've seen this on numerous times. We've seen Abraham building altars and calling upon the name of the Lord, but I've also drawn to your attention the fact that there are many times when we don't see it happening. Abraham made significant decisions, and there was no calling upon the name of the Lord. And I think it reminds us of the ups and downs that we have as people of faith. Abraham was a godly man. He was a man of faith, but his faith was not always as consistent as it could have been or should have been. And there were times when he did not call upon the name of the Lord, and he brought trouble into his life and the lives of his family. Nevertheless, in spite of his inconsistencies, God was faithful. In God's good time, the son of promise eventually came. Now Abraham is settling into the land promised by God. Now it would be over 400 years before the children of Israel would take possession of the land properly, but here we see the beginning. Here is the beginning of it, God's faithfulness to Abraham. He breaks soil and he plants the terebinth tree, the first, no doubt, of many, many trees. And just as the tree would put down roots into the soil, so Abraham is putting down roots, and he calls upon the name of the Lord. No doubt he is dedicating himself and his family and this land to the Lord, and he is praying for their blessing to be, praying for God's blessing to be upon all that he is doing. Now, the promised land was not ultimately Abraham's home. It pointed to something far better. The world in its present state is not our home. Nevertheless, we need to put down roots. We need to be committed to the purposes of God. Life will bring change. Life brought many changes to the world of Abraham. But we should seek the Lord's blessing. We should seek to be committed to what the Lord is doing and to put down roots. We should seek to be as settled as we possibly can in the midst of change and things that go on around and about us. We should seek to be settled in life. It is a blessing to know familiarity, regularity and commitment and just the regular everyday ebbs and flows of life as we seek to serve the Lord. It's true to say that we don't want to grow stale in life, and change can be a good thing, but we ought not to be people who are always seeking the next adventure. We ought not to be people who are always looking somewhere else because the grass is greener. And I think we've seen something of that in Abraham. He suddenly just uproots himself and he goes south and then he goes here and then he's back down south and he's in Egypt and then he's in the land where Abimelech is, in Gerar. Now the man is settled. There is a commitment to the land. He calls upon the name of the Lord. He's planting trees. He's digging wells. He's putting down roots. And that is a good thing in life. Just regularity, familiarity, serving the Lord where we are. Not always looking for something new and something exciting. Well, we close then this evening. It's a fairly mundane passage. Okay, we don't have fire falling from heaven in this passage. We don't have the destruction of cities. We don't have sordid sexual accounts. We don't have journeys or anything like that that we've seen in the past with Abraham. We have two men, Abraham and Abimelech. They make a treaty. They share a bear hug and Abraham plants a tree. Not much to report here. Not much really going on. On the contrary, this is loaded with instruction for us. There are many lessons in this, and God has provided this passage for our instruction. We can see here how two men were able to get along, deal with differences. We can see gracious men, men of goodwill, men of integrity, fair-mindedness, being reasonable, able to shake hands and make the most of the situation in which they found themselves in. Well, may the Lord open our hearts to receive the ministry of his word. May he teach us valuable, valuable lessons, even from those portions of scripture where we don't think much is happening. All scripture is inspired by God for our instruction, and there are always many lessons to learn. May he bless his word to our hearts. Amen.